Our last case for argument is 23-1816, Howard v. HHS. Mr. Kalinowski, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Isaiah Kalinowski from Boston Legal Group, representing appellant petitioner Mark Howard. We're really grateful today for the opportunity to clarify an issue that's been a very big concern with what we do day-to-day in the vaccine court. And the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Even though it's not something the court hears all the time, I just want to underscore how important this particular issue is for our day-to-day practice. Over the last few years, there's been a dispute regarding how to interpret this court's precedent regarding the appropriate metric for evaluating petitioners' medical theories of causation, theories that form an integral part of every one of the actual causation cases before the court. Every case, it's not a table case, and I mean, I assume the court understands the distinction there. Every case has to deal with this issue. So that's why I want to underscore its importance. Respondent has urged, and the special master in this case accepted, a requirement that the vaccine at issue more likely than not does cause this injury in a way that it has been proven. And then not just that the theory is plausible, which is what we would argue has been the standard of this court, but that it actually exists. We have proof of that.
Let me just ask a question. Are you challenging the state of our existing precedent such that this is the kind of issue that really properly belongs before the in-bank court, or are you saying despite the articulation of that precedent, we can meet it?
I'm asking you to reaffirm what has been this court's precedent for 30 some odd years, since the 80s. So I'm not going to repeat everything that we said in the brief, but essentially going back to the very end of Alton, which is we would say is sort of the centerpiece of our jurisprudence from this court.
I thought your brief recognized that, if I remember right, that I think, as you put it, at least starting in Moberly, our precedent veered off in the wrong direction. I thought you argued we misinterpreted the pre-existing precedents.
No, and if so, that's the way it came across. I have to apologize. Our point is that because the way Moberly is phrased, Moberly, and that's why it's cited twice in that string site, Moberly at one place understands and acknowledges that the standard for the metric for proving general causation is a biologically plausible theory. Later on, it says, okay, but this petitioner stopped there, didn't go on to establish how, in this particular facts, this applied, and then says that proving plausibility is not sufficient under those circumstances. But the problem was then that phrasing is then used as a way of misapplying what had been accepted earlier in that same decision as the standard metric for proving general causation, the theory, the medical theory. So that the problem is then that, you know, iterative process, the next time it's addressed, say, the case of WC, and I guess to make a long story short, I'm asking what has been the law since before Alton, since going back to Grant in the 90s, but all the way through the 2000s until really this 2011-2012 period, was the precedent, is the precedent, and has still been in later cases, still recognized in cases like Sharp that we cited. There's this thread of misunderstanding about the court's jurisprudence, and I don't know, you know, to the extent that the later decisions, cases like WC or Boatman, stray from that prior precedent, then they're not controlling. But I think there's a way to resolve them, and I think that we cited a case from the lower court of federal claims called Jay, from Judge Holt, that actually does says this, and Cottonstedt, which we also cited, which is an unpublished decision, also says there's no, Boatman doesn't, you know, you guys are off on the wrong track. Boatman, Moberly, these cases don't actually depart from a plausibility standard. You're misreading us. The problem is that misreading is happening all the time in lots of cases. And so we really, you know, it'd be nice to have some way to reconcile all these cases that otherwise seem to be in conflict. And even in some of the briefing on this issue, you know, things will talk about, well, then Moberly did this as if it could change prior precedent.
But, the statute says that causation has to be proved by a preponderance, is that right?
It says that the standard of proof for proving facts, the sufficient amount of facts to prove each element, not causation, each element, whether it was given in the United States, whether it was 6 months of symptoms, all the elements of 11C, which are the prima facie elements, everything has to be proved through preponderance of evidence, which is similar for every, in most civil cases.
Including causation.
Including the elements of causation.
Right, no, I think it's even harder for you if it has to be, let's assume it's causation as a whole. And you understand, I think, or you characterize sort of Alfin prong one as general causation, and then two and three is different elements of specific causation. That is what happened for the particular plaintiff. But assume that you had 100% certainty about the timing of the vaccine in relation to the injury that occurs. 100% certainty about the plaintiff's symptoms, so put aside any dispute about medical records versus personal testimony.
Sure.
But all you had on the general theory, which is to say the general proposition that under some specified conditions, this type of vaccine is the cause of this kind of injury, is, say, a 30% probability. How do you get more than 50% probability of causation?
And I'm glad you phrased it that way, Your Honor, because the problem is not that this injury is caused by it. Is caused is the problem. That's not the burden. Biologic plausibility, so again, it's helpful to kind of work.
This is why I started with the statute.
Yeah.
Assume, as I think is true,
yes,
that causation of the vaccination, the particular administration of the vaccine to the injury has to be shown by preponderance. Like, it's a basic element of the case.
Actual causation needs, the facts supporting the proof of actual causation need to be proved to a preponderance of the evidence, the fact being true or untrue. What is involved in proving actual causation is from the common law, and it's but-for causation and proximate causation, and then how that's interpreted in the medical context is in general causation and specific causation, meaning can it, did it. And whether it does, whether we do not have to prove that the vaccine does cause this injury. That's what the special master said we had to do, and that's incorrect from this court's precedent. We have to prove, because that's not ultimately what we're trying to prove. This court has said that's for scientists.
So you don't think that a general causation requirement, assuming that preponderance applies to that, I'm talking as a logical matter, put aside our precedent for now,
mm-hmm.
Okay, requires that there be some identified conditions under which it is more likely than not that if the injury occurs, the vaccine was the cause of it.
We have a situation where that occurs, that's called the table injuries. So where that proof is available, where there is proof available that the vaccine does cause or has been established to cause this type of injury, then it's administratively added to this table, and then those injuries, the causation is presumed. We're talking about the outlier cases where this injury has never been understood before to be related to a vaccine, or there's not enough proof, and the IOM has said we don't have enough proof here to make it determined one way or another, and as a general matter. So then we're looking at, and this is in Capizano, we're not looking at it as a general matter, we're looking at it for this specific petitioner. The problem is we still have to figure out, well, okay, for this particular petitioner, could this have happened? Is it logical, is this plausible? From a biological standpoint, which is what we say, biological plausibility, that this could happen, okay, well, then let's see if that's actually what happened here in the individual case. But if to the extent that we are not proving as a general matter, and furthermore, if there was proof that, and this is in the expert report, the experts talked about this in the appendix, and I can draw the page if need be, but the experts said if there was proof that a vaccine caused an injury to this extent, it would be pulled. And we have this has happened historically, where a certain vaccine is pulled.
It would be
pulled, it would be taken off the market.
Oh.
So we're dealing with every single one of these cases that's in an actual causation context. There was never sufficient proof to prove as a general matter that the vaccine does cause this injury. It's never there. So now the question is, okay, well, what do we do now? And this court, and Alfin, and Pafford, and all these places, at the very end of 1281 of Pafford, I'm sorry, of Alfin, it says, dismissing the Stevens test, which it was getting rid of because it required additional criteria, they said proving a medically plausible theory.
I'm sorry, Stevens was the one about.
Stevens was the one.
Can I finish?
Yes, I'm sorry, sir.
That required something in the nature of certain kinds of medical evidence.
Right.
And Alfin said, no, we don't, that we're not limited to that kind of proof. Any other kind of proof will do. But the question is what you have to prove.
Correct. And I'm going into my rebuttal time, so I'll try to be brief because I do want to touch on the other issues. Stevens tried to basically use Daubert criteria, testability, publication, theories. Was this particular theory proven in an article somewhere? And usually it's not. They said you can't require that as proof of plausibility. But it says at the end, but aside from that, proof of biologic plausibility with elimination, and then the specific causation factors, temporal association and elimination of other factors is all we've ever required. That's what we required. That's what the circuit said in 2005, reaffirmed in Sharp, reaffirmed in these other places. Anyways, I don't want to belabor that. If your honors are satisfied with that, I would like to actually just address the other two points briefly.
Okay. Briefly.
Very briefly, the issue preclusion issue is one that is a very big concern just because of what it specifically did. In this issue preclusion, the special master said, I've already decided as a factual conclusion that this evidence isn't relevant in this context. That wasn't challenged in this case. Respondent didn't raise it. Respondent's expert didn't raise it. No one challenged it. In fact, respondent's expert in their report, and I can pull the appendix page, respondent's expert said in the report, this person had GBS, and then this diagnosis changed to CIDP when they had a relapse. So no one disputed bringing up the relevance of CIDP literature, I'm sorry, GBS literature into a CIDP case, so the situations are similar. And the special master said, no, you can't do that. I already decided in these other cases that doesn't work, and so you can't do that in this case. And then going back to your Honor's point about the statute itself, the statutory language defines the record of what the special master can assess in an individual case, and it's the record of this case, not some other case. And given the fact that these proceedings are closed, it's something that this petitioner didn't have access to, is the record in some other case. So anyways, with that, I will try to preserve the remainder of rebuttal unless Your Honor have any questions on this.
No, thank you, Mr. Kalinowski. Ms. Kurosh, am I saying it right?
Yes.
Yes, Ms. Kurosh.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Your Honors, there is no reversible error in this case. The Chief Special Master applied the correct legal standard. He considered the entire record. He thoughtfully weighed the evidence. He drew reasonable inferences, and he provided reasoned and supported explanations for his findings. So essentially, he did his job, and on appeal, the standard is highly deferential. This Court doesn't reweigh the evidence or second-guess the fact finder's fact-intensive conclusions. Of course, reasonable people can differ, and petitioner is entitled to a different view, but the Chief Special Master's decision was not arbitrary and capricious, it was not an abuse of discretion, and it was not contrary to the law, so it must stand. Now, if I could just address first the legal question that petitioner raised. Your Honors, preponderance has been the standard of proof since the inception of the program. It's in the Act, as Judge Taranto pointed out, it's Section 13 of the Vaccine Act. It says preponderance. And virtually every circuit case since 1991 has said preponderance. And I would direct the Court to page 12 of Respondent's brief that enumerates these cases. Now, in 2005, Alfin created this three-pronged framework for causation and fact cases that more specifically spells out exactly what petitioners need to show. But again, Alfin says that they have to show those prongs by a preponderance of the evidence. And every case since then has affirmed that. Now, there are a handful of cases that more particularly specify that applies to theory in particular, meaning that to the extent that petitioners or the special masters have misunderstood and thought that something less than preponderance applies to prong one, which is theory, this Court has explicitly stated in Dobrydnev in 2014, in Oliver and Olson, which were in 2018, in Boatman, which was in 2019, and of course in Moberly and Brokelchen, which petitioner referenced in 2010. This court has specifically said that preponderance applies to the theory prong, which is the first prong. So there really is no question.
Can you state what proposition for prong one is needs to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence?
Yes.
It can't be that by a preponderance of the evidence, there exists a theory out there that causally connects things.
Yes, Your Honor. Prong one is that a particular vaccine can cause a particular injury. It's often called general causation. So meaning a petitioner would have to prove by preponderant evidence that a particular vaccine can cause a particular injury. Prong two is often called specific causation. Did it cause in this case? So one, prong one is can cause, prong two is did it cause. So then you would look at the petitioner's particular course, their clinical course, their findings, the things their doctor
and
said.
How do you connect the word can to preponderance?
Well, Your Honor, that...
Does it mean that there are conditions under which it is more likely than not that if this injury is present, the cause is the vaccine?
I think it's up to the special masters to determine that, Your Honor. They are
Is that the question?
The question being, can a vaccine cause...
No, my formulation did not use the word can. That is, I'm trying to understand what it means to say by a preponderance of the evidence that the vaccine can cause it. Does that or does that not mean that under certain conditions it is more likely than not that when the injury appears, the cause was the vaccine?
Do you mean
the word can covers too much territory. I want to translate into something that is more understandable, at least to me.
Do you mean certain medical conditions?
Conditions for the proposition that that if the injury occurs under the following conditions, that the vaccine preceded the injury by less than 30 days. The symptom is this. The symptom lasts for this long. The patient doesn't have other conditions. Sorry for doubly using the
sure.
word. That under those circumstances, it is more likely than not that the cause of these conditions was the vaccine.
No, Your Honor, I don't think there are any particular conditions or circumstances that can be specified. And in fact,
how do you know what to look for when you get to prongs two and three? Aren't you looking for those conditions?
So prong one has to do with theory in general. Prong two would have to do with whether the theory manifests in that particular case as with respect to that particular petitioner. You look at their clinical course, do they match what the theory has put forward? And then prong three, which is a medically acceptable temporal relationship, actually takes a piece of both. It looks at what the theory predicts.
So
let
me just put it a different way. I'm not sure why plausibility isn't a perfectly sensible English language word for the word can.
Because, Your Honor, plausibility is less than preponderance. Plausibility...
But you said what has to be preponderant is that it can cause.
Yes, Your Honor. But preponderance is the quantum of proof. More likely than not, more probable than not, legally probable. That's the language this court has used in many cases. Lalonde, Moberly, Alfin, even going back to Knudsen. Probable, more probable than not, more likely than not. As you said, greater than 50%. That's what preponderant is. Plausible.
You mean more likely than not that it can cause, i.e. that there, it might cause, like that there, it has happened in the past, that there has been a causal link once, even if it's only once out of 100,000 cases, you think that that meets the preponderance of the evidence standard?
It would depend on the evidence in that case, Your Honor, because the special masters are supposed to look at the particular mix of evidence put forward, and as you discussed with petitioner's counsel, there's no particular type of evidence that can be required, or particular category of evidence that can be required. The special master can't say you must put forward epidemiological evidence, or you must put forward mechanistic evidence, or you must put forward case reports. There's no particular category that's required. The special master looks at the total mix of the evidence and determines whether a petitioner has preponderantly met his burden. Prong one being can cause medical theory, prong two being logical sequence of cause and effect did cause in this case, prong three being temporal relationship.
I guess I'm, I'll be honest, I'm sort of a little bit surprised at the argument. What is the gray area between biologically plausible and can cause? Biologically plausible means, you know, this may well be the cause, right? Plausible, this might be the reason. That feels like can. That feels like it meets the word can.
I think, Your Honor, because many things are possible or even plausible, but they're not probable. And this court has said so particularly. For instance, in Beaumont, this court said, we have consistently reiterated that a plausible or possible causal theory does not satisfy the standard. In Moberly, proof of a plausible or possible causal link between the vaccine and the injury is not the standard. In Brokelshin, the question is whether petitioners provided proof by a preponderance of the evidence of a medical theory. So I think plausible, and petitioner recognizes this in his brief, in his reply rather, pages 7 through 12 of his reply, he has an extended discussion regarding how plausibility is actually less than preponderance. It is less than probability, and he discusses Iqbal and Twombly, the Supreme Court precedents that talk about pleading standards. So I think it's a lower standard of proof. And that's why the Chief Special Master
forget what he's arguing. I guess I'm just trying to understand what you're arguing. So, preponderance of the evidence, there has to be a preponderance of evidence that it can cause this, like meaning it happened once. That's the part I'm sort of continuing to struggle with.
It means that there's evidence. It means that there's medical or scientific evidence, whether it's epidemiological, mechanistic, whatnot, that shows a causal link between this vaccination and this injury. Now, even if they prevail on prong one, they might still lose on prong two, because it could be that in this particular petitioner's case, there are other factors that show that even that theory wouldn't apply here. So each prong has to be met by independent evidence. So prong one, yes, could be met as a general matter based on existing epidemiological or mechanistic or whatever other kind of evidence. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the petitioner in this case satisfies that theory under prong two or under prong three, which is temporal relationship.
Okay, but going back to the language of plausibility, to the extent it's present in the case law, I recognize that in certain instances it looks like it's just a repetition of what's been presented in the papers. But what cases specifically do you think have actually dissected that and brought forth its meaning and what was really intended and how this was supposed to be implied?
None, Your Honor. None, Your Honor. Every time that this court actually grapples with the standard of proof and looks at what the Act requires, it says preponderant evidence. And sometimes, as I mentioned, it defines it as probable or more likely than not. The handful of times where the word plausible is used, it's mentioned in passing. There's sort of these passing references to the word that don't really implicate it in any meaningful way. And that includes Pafford, Walther, Rickett, Palak, and Sharp, which petitioner cites in his reply brief. In all of those cases, there's no
real... What about the Andrew case?
So Andreu is the case that maybe arguably comes the closest to sounding like it's endorsing plausibility, but even then, it doesn't really address medical theory in any meaningful way because that case turned on prong two, which was logical sequence of cause and effect, meaning specific causation, mm-hmm. and it dealt specifically with the treating physician's testimony in that case. They were discussing that particular petitioner's presentation. So Andreu doesn't meaningfully grapple with the standard of proof or articulate anything less than preponderance, probability. And it couldn't, because this court has, as I say, since 1991, in every case, including Alfin, articulated preponderance. Now, if I could just turn briefly to the question of issue preclusion,
I'm kind of interested in this, not because of issue preclusion. I don't think there's an issue preclusion going on here, but there is this very interesting and at least question raising. I'm not suggesting an answer. Question raising practice of use in case number 12 of things from cases number 1 through 11. And in which at least some of the record in cases 1 through 11 is sealed from outsiders. How does kind of normal notice, opportunity to meet, fairness work out when in case number 12 the plaintiff is faced with the special master looking at cases 1 through 11? I have some ideas, but I'm interested in your ideas.
So I think, Your Honor, for instance, in this case, the Chief Special Master, when he discussed the past case law regarding GBS and CIDP cases, he cited those cases for the medical theory analysis, which really turned on publicly available medical literature. And that literature is often, you know, very specifically cited in the cases. So it's easy to find. Experts can find it. They can read it. They can review it. They can comment.
Indeed, special masters are supposed to write comprehensive opinions, and they
cite
all of this public stuff, just not the personal private stuff.
Exactly, Your Honor. And, you know, as mentioned in our brief, this is page 25, note 9, the special masters do have inquisitorial powers in the program. They're directed to become specialists with acquired knowledge. So just mentioning past cases and what their analysis of, for instance, publicly available medical literature is, doesn't amount to issue preclusion. And in fact, in this case...
Forget about issue preclusion.
Okay.
Really, forget about issue preclusion. The question is whether there's some notice and fairness problem with the adjudicator relying on material from other cases, much of which is secret.
I don't think so, Your Honor, partly for the reasons I stated, but partly also because the Chief Special Master specifically said in this case that he was relying on evidence in this case. He talked about the evidence that petitioner's expert, Dr. Shake, put forward, and respondent's expert, Dr. Vartanian, put forward.
You think it's proper, and if memory serves maybe incorrectly, government certainly has argued when it's gotten the 12th case of the same basic theory, you've rejected that before, as if that was what? Precedent? It's not precedent, it's a factual question.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's not precedential. It's not controlling in any way.
Right, so how does that become a factual question when the records in those cases are not available to the plaintiff? You've already given one answer, which is that on the general causation question, what's relied on is material that will be available. What else?
Well, I think to the extent that what is discussed in those cases is public, for instance, you know, it may be that the petitioner's medical records in their entirety are not available, but to the extent that the special master summarizes those medical records and the relevant issues that bear on their analysis, yes, all of that is available in these detailed decisions. And you know, all of the citations to the medical literature, all of that, petitioners can look at that in future cases the same way that the government can.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kalinowski?
Sorry, Your Honor, did you want me to address any of the other issues that petitioner raised?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to keep brief, and I appreciate we're almost done here. I want to just circle back to something we already talked about, which is what needs to be proved to a preponderance. The theory itself, that, you know, by this biologic mechanism, the vaccine causes this injury, or simply preponderant proof that the theory that has been propounded is biologically plausible, and to Chief Judge Moore's point, that by that formulation, it can cause. And I want to reemphasize that respondent's position is that it's actually the petitioner's job to prove the theory, to prove the theory correct, something that, you know, can't be done scientifically in this particular injury. There's not scientific proof of that level for any cause, and they're expecting us to prove it for a vaccine. Respondent says in their brief that we must demonstrate the theory by preponderance of the evidence, not some aspect of theory, not even that the theory can cause this. And I guess there are four, we all agree that this can cause, does cause rubric, right, that she mentioned. We all agree on that point. And her formulation, I appreciate that it's not something that this court deals with, you know, on a daily basis, but that is that's our stock and trade. We prove that the theoretical mechanism by which we propose this vaccine causes injury, and then we show that's what's going on here. And then the timing response. And that's exactly those three things. What I just said, as you read, like I say, the 1281, the end of Alton, it says this is all that's required, and it uses biologic plausibility there, just as it does in Pafford, just as it does in Walther, and going back and forward. And I think, you know, with that, I won't address the rest of our, we also had a specific causation issue in this case, but given the time involved, and I appreciate that we definitely got over time. I'm grateful for the time and I do sincerely, and I apologize if I sound overly passionate about it. We just don't get a lot of time up with you guys. So we really, really would appreciate, I think I speak for Respondents Council, we really, really would appreciate a very, some clarification on this, because it comes up in every case. And so I'm grateful for the time. Thank you all.
Thank both counsel for their argument. This case is taken under submission.